Hi, it's Dr. Squee here. I'm here to tell you about my live video podcast event, Squeefest 2020, brought to you by StreamYard. 2 p.m. to 2 p.m. British Summer Time or 9 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern, I will be going live for 24 hours on the Dr. Squee Show Facebook page and twitch.tv/Dr. Squee to raise money for NHS Charities Together, who are supporting NHS staff and volunteers who are bringing the fight to COVID-19. We will have guest stars including the third Doctor, Doctor Who companion Katie Manning. From Going Live, we have Trevor Simon. Stand-up comedian Anubhav Pal will be bringing Mumbai to the event, and we'll have so many more guest stars to announce. As well as that, we have quizzes, games, panels with authors and ghost hunters. We've also got your favourite podcasts, Retrek, Netheads, Legend in My Spare Time, Due South by Southeast, Unclassical, Dead Piet Society, Talking Codswallop, Diversely Geek, Legend of the Travelling TARDIS, Dog's Best Friend, and Blame Makes Food. As well as all that, our friends over at SW20 Radio, The Sound of South Wales, will be broadcasting an hour of Squeefest with our friend Matt Lees. Please follow our Facebook page and at Dr. Squee on Twitter and Instagram for more guest announcements as we have them. All this and so much more. If you can afford to donate, please go to justgiving.com/Squeefest now or on the day and give what you can. And join me for 24 hours of fun. I'll see you there. Hello and welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. I'm Dr. Squee and this is my show. This week, we're very excited to welcome Ian Waits to the show. He's a friend who I've made at the Sci-Fi Weekender convention. I'm an absolutely lovely guy, such an accomplished writer, and so modest with it as well. We just had a great time. This one, it's probably the earliest that we've done a turnaround from recording to it coming out in podcast form. That's because, honestly, we've reached the end of our levy of podcasts that we've got. So usually we like to have a few in hand. Just due to ranging Squeefest, to be honest with you, I've not had the time to kind of record extra episodes to get some bank. So we just run out. So next week, I'm not sure if there's going to be a show. I'm going to try and put something together, either a new interview or maybe something from the archives of Gallifrey Stands, which was my previous podcast where I interviewed quite a lot of celebrities. So I might fish something out there, or I might be able to get another podcast recorded in the meantime. If not, if there's a gap next week, that'll be why. But it's very exciting. We're just now, less than 2 weeks away from Squeefest, and the lineup's looking great. We really hope you are going to join us, as well as on the advert there at the beginning, as well as all the people mentioned there. We've also got Alexander Siddig, who was Dr. Bashir in Deep Space Nine. And there's another guest we've still got to announce. Hopefully it's going to pull off. I'm just waiting for confirmation. And so please do watch our social media, the Dr. Squee Show on Facebook, or go to Instagram or Twitter at Dr. Squee. It's such an exciting but busy time. As well as that, I'm also recording the sitcom which I'm in, the podcast sitcom Four's a Crowd, which you can check out on your favourite podcatcher, which is based around four single people in a flat in America who are just trying to get through the vagaries of dating and life in their 30s, which is really interesting. I'm the narrator, I guess, because I'm in my 40s, so I couldn't be one of the people. But I of course, auditioned for the narrator, and very pleased to be the narrator on this exciting new project. The first episode is up now, and second one's coming very soon. So please do check that out, and download like crazy on your favourite podcatcher. What else is happening? I mean, I've got a busy old time at the moment. I'm also just about to start a new job, just waiting for all the checks to come back. Just trying to organize 24 hours worth of podcasting. I've literally this morning just come back from the hospital, had an ingrown toenail operated on. So everything is happening at once at the moment. We're just now also looking at moving house. I don't know why I do all this to myself at the same time, but there we go. Exciting yet busy times. So without further ado, I'm not going to talk too much because I just don't have the time. It's just too busy, too manic at the moment. But we've got a wonderful show for you. Please enjoy my interview with Ian Waits, the first one to be streamed on video with video credits on there. Oh, sorry, just one last thing I will say. Because we are working with a new webcam, which is fantastic, it's actually a little portable camera, so I can use it at events as well. So that's really a great plus. But it did mean that the settings on it, I'm still getting used to. And when I plugged it in, the audio defaulted to the camera. And actually, I was really impressed. The audio is pretty good for a portable camera. It does actually come with a little plug-in microphone you can use when you're going out to events. So the sound's a little bit tinny, but it's actually okay. I'm really impressed by the sound on this. So if it sounds a little bit different, that's the only reason why. That's why it's kind of slightly, slightly different, the sound, but very impressed. I know I seem to be saying this kind of like quite a few weeks, that there's something or another with the sound or with the video, but that's only because I'm constantly trying to upgrade to get it to a really decent quality. So the picture now is in 4K and whatever the maximum is to go out and stream on Facebook. I think it's 1080, but very good quality for the video, and the audio hopefully will get better and better as well. So anyway, as I say, without further ado, here's my interview with Mr. Ian Waites. Hello, and welcome to the Doug the Squee Show.
Welcome to the show with your friend and mine. So tell me, Dr. Squee, who's it gonna be this time? We like to hear you talk, but we love to hear you listen. And if you are not subscribed, you won't know what you're missing. So welcome to the Doug the Squee Show. Welcome to the Doug the Squee Show. Welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. Tonight, Squee welcomes
Ian White.
And now here's the man himself, Dr. Squee.
Hello, and as I say, welcome to the Dr. Squee Show, now with kind of theme tune and video, all playing through the video version as well as the audio. I know, it's way too professional for me. Trust me, this level of professionalism will not hold up. We are very thankful to StreamYard, the people who provide the streaming technology for Gallifrey Stand. I went to my old show for a second there. See, I told you the lack of professionalism would return. But they provide the streaming technology, which we use on the Dr. Squee Show. And they are providing us for the month of Squeefest, which I will tell you about in a second. They're providing us with their deluxe sort of like premiere package, which means I can do things like play that video. So thank you very much to StreamYard. Please do check them out if you're doing any streaming event on the internet. It is wonderful. There's a free version. And then if you want to get a bit more kind of like technical, do a few extra things, you can do that too. You may also notice there's a slight jump in video for tonight's show. That's because I've got a new webcam. So you're seeing me in glorious 4K. So I'm sorry about these huge bags under my eyes. And being able to see me clearly probably is not working in your favor. So I apologize to the audience for that. But I mentioned Squeefest before. On the 19th and 20th, which is Saturday and Sunday, in just under 2 weeks, from 2 p.m. to 2 p.m., I'm going to be going live for 24 hours. Yeah, 24 hours of me. I know it sounds like way too much me, and you're right. But the good thing is I've got loads of guests, so you don't just have to put up with me. You've got Katie Manning, the companion for the Third Doctor in Doctor Who. She played Jo Grant, of course, and Jo Jones in the Sarah Jane Adventures. We've got Alexander Siddig, who played Dr. Bashir in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Comedian Anubhav Powell from India. If you haven't heard of him, trust me, he's hilarious. You can check out his special now on Amazon Prime. And Trevin Simon. And we've got a whole host of podcasts, live panels with authors such as Sam Stone and Colm Sanson Regan, and loads of stuff going on throughout the day. So please do join us for that. So just a quick plug for that. And speaking of authors, you see I'm getting slick here. Speaking of authors, my guest tonight is award-winning author, editor, publisher, and director of the British Science Fiction Association. He also sits as judge on the Arthur C. Clarke Awards and is, like the most of us, his website tells me he spends his spare time worrying about things he should be doing. Well, that certainly rings a chime with me anyway. Please welcome to the Dr. Squee Show, Ian Waites. Hello, Ian. Oh, we've lost your sound there, Ian, I think.
Okay.
Hey!
Try that.
You know what? I will fully accept blame because I muted you while the thing was playing.
Exactly.
Luckily, lack of professionalism will return, and here it is.
Luckily, I saw a button saying unmute and I pressed it and it seems to have worked. So
you see, I can't even work out the unmute button. 24 hours, what am I thinking?
I'm not even going to go there. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I did an interview the other day promoting it on a friend's radio station, SW20, who are going to be playing an hour of the event when I'm going to be on radio there. And I said, it's like, you know, the kid who gets sent to the shed after being caught smoking a cigarette and, you know, has to smoke the whole pack. And then a week later, I've gone, ooh, cigarettes, because I did this once before and you'd think I'd learn from that.
You're clearly a slow learner, but good luck. As I say, it's a fantastic cause. I really hope it goes well for you.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I didn't mention NHS Charities Together is what it's being done in aid of. And please, if you want to, you can donate right now to anyone watching justgiving.com/squeefest. And of course, that will be open on the day. But why not get in early? Donate something now and then just watch guilt-free on the day. Obviously, if people can't afford to donate, though, it is all about just providing a bit of entertainment as well as providing money for a good cause. But Ian, we're not here to talk about Squeefest. We're here.
I was going to say, I feel as if I'm on Red Nose Day or something at the moment.
I'm just getting telephone mode early, I think. Is what's happening. But Ian, how's lockdown treating you? How are you doing with this crazy world of ours right now?
Well, it's interesting because obviously I write science fiction and you try and predict the future or you try and paint a picture of the future. But I don't think any of us envisaged what we've been through in the past sort of year. This has been a very, very strange one. Personally, it's been an interesting one because I tend to spend a lot of time locked away at home without seeing anyone in front of a computer anyway. So this has almost been just an extreme extension of that. But on the other hand, I didn't mind not going out when it was my choice not to go out. When I was suddenly told you can't go out, all of a sudden I wanted to run out everywhere and go everywhere. And I think there's a certain perverse lack of discipline in showing there. But hey, there you go. We got through it. We're here. So far, so good.
I mean, you know, obviously all my friends are taking this very seriously. I'm very pleased to see that. But like a lot of my author friends are saying, it's like, oh, sorry, has there been a plague or something happening? I lock myself in anyway. Just need a bit more mad at the shops.
I think we're probably better equipped to deal with it than many people, for which I'm very grateful. I never knew there was going to be an advantage to being a self-imposed hermit, but apparently there is.
Yes, indeed. But to get to happier times, so it all started for you, it seems, that you were watching sci-fi TV a lot on TV, and genre TV kind of really influenced you. But it was The Chrysalids and an audio drama which kind of really sparked your interest.
Well, it was a long, long time ago, and I'm going back to, I'm an old man now, I'm in the 60s, which is horrifying. I don't know how that happened. But yeah, as a kid, I listened to I think it was a Radio 4 show, and it was basically a dramatisation of The Chrysalids by John Wyndham. And I related to this character who was perhaps not the most popular, who was a bit outside the norm and who had something different about him. And the whole thing totally captivated me. And that was really my gateway into starting to explore science fiction. I read Wyndham's books and then got into the popular authors at the time, which were sort of Asimov, Clarke, people of that nature. I never really got into Robert Heinlein, but a lot of the other authors, traditional Golden Age authors, and started reading those and read them avidly. And that was really my way in.
And I find it interesting that it was The Chrysalids which kind of piqued your interest, because when I was at school, I had and have dyslexia, and it was one of the books which I did, because I was kind of had a quite decent reading age, but it was just the writing and stuff. So I was kind of fascinated. And that book is one of those ones. And the other ones you've named there are ones which are very relatable to a young person whilst expressing some very big ideas. Did you find that with those kind of authors?
Oh, very much so. And I mean, another author I didn't mention who was a huge, huge influence on me on the early days was Andrea Norton. I read a lot of her science fiction. And again, there was a series she did, the Janus books, about a race on a planet which had virtually been eradicated, and they left seed pods which could germinate and affect the next race who discovered them, which turned out to be humans and turned them into changelings. And I just loved that whole concept. So yes, all these authors, excuse me, it was a whole concept of looking beyond the norm, of expanding the, thinking outside the box. I mean, I tried reading thrillers and crime stories, which my parents read, and they didn't really do anything for me. But something like this, which took things beyond and made me think and made me go, wow, it was the sense of wonder. And that's really what captured me.
I find this is what's so wonderful about kind of science fiction fantasy. It brings, like, I mean, I really, I was a bizarre child. I really love Shakespeare.
That doesn't surprise me at all, but then.
for a dyslexic child, though, to be really liking Shakespeare and these big ideas. And I think that's what I loved about sci-fi. I didn't actually see Shakespeare and sci-fi as that different. And I believe that kind of relates to you a little bit as well, which I read up.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. You're probably referring to the school story I wrote where I was, we were commissioned to write an essay on the language of Shakespeare. And I turned in a science fiction story where some of the bards' ancient English language, which was no longer understood in the future, was used as a clue for an assassination. So, yes, it fitted the title. And we were just given, that's the title, write an essay. So I did, and I got good marks. So I got away with it, yeah.
I don't know. As I say, maybe this is just you and I here, but like, I don't find that big a leap myself. I find, of course, like the big ideas of Shakespeare, what a perfect setting to go into a kind of bigger world.
Well, if you read sort of stuff like, I mean, Dune was one of the books that really affected me very early on, and Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, one very large book, one very slender, but both of them have a tremendous amount of world building, and Le Guin in quite sparse detail, Herbert in quite sprawling, magnificent detail. And as you say, you can look at that and look at the worlds that Shakespeare created and see that there is a parity there. There is a comparison to be made. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was in the 80s then that you started sending stuff off. What kind of like sparked to actually start sending things in to be published?
Well, English was always the subject I loved at work, at school. I loved writing. And yes, I mean, in the 80s, long before the internet, you know, it was a case of writing something, putting it in an envelope, putting a stamp on it, posting off and waiting months for a return. I sent stuff all over the place to Asimov's, to Interzone, etc. But I got published in a couple of smaller magazines in the UK. And one of the stories got nominated for a BSFA award at some point, which was just phenomenal to me. I mean, I think it was only long listed, so it didn't get anywhere. But for a young lad sort of writing, I suppose I was in my 20s at that stage, it meant a great deal. But then I sort of, for various reasons, moved away from writing in the late 80s. And it was about 16 years before I came back to it. So, but yes, I mean, I think that's your end, not mine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's yours. And my dog, Benny, was not a fan of you moving away from writing. He mourns those wasted years.
Yeah. On the other hand, I came back a much better writer than I was in the 80s, I promise you.
Okay, I'm sure he will calm down having heard that news now. this is the kind of thing I'm worried about. 24 hours, he's going to be barking. Like, what if the internet goes down? These are all my nightmares here.
Yeah, and when your mum rings to see how you are or something, yeah.
Yep, that literally happened last stream. So thank you for putting that extra one.
Hey, no problem.
But when you were sending these up, so what was the kind of hit rate? Like, how many did you send off, for instance, before the first one got published?
Oh, I can't remember now. I mean, you're going back a long, long time ago. But when I came back to writing, I started sending off to Interzone, to Asimov's, to Amazing, the big magazines in America mainly. And that had the disadvantage of most of those in, I'm going back now, I suppose nearly 20 years ago, 16, 17 yeah. years ago. And most of those weren't accepting emailed submissions. They had to be posted still. So there was that disadvantage. But also it occurred to me that I was probably aiming at the topper echelons and maybe I should start lower. So I started sending off to other places. And I got into, fairly early on, I got into a fairly thick-skinned mode. So at that point, there was 1 year when I determined to have one story a month accepted. And I started sending off, and my hit rate at that stage was probably one in about 11 submissions I got accepted. but I submitted about 120 times in that first year and got, I think, 13 acceptances. So that meant...
That up is, I think that's very important for people to realize that's the kind of tenacity you have to have, and that especially in a day where you had to, as you say, like physically print it out and send it off to places.
Well, by this point, a lot of the smaller magazines especially were accepting internet submissions, you know, emailed, so it wasn't so onerous. And what I would do if I got a story rejected, if there were comments from the editor, I'd have a look. I was big-headed enough not always to accept them, but to say, OK, I can see your point here, give it a polish and try within a day or so and send it off again. So the story might go off 8 or 9 times in the course of a year or whatever. But I got 13 acceptances. I was lucky enough to sell some to some fairly prestigious larger magazines and concerned. Got my SAFWA membership that I was interested in at the time, which I subsequently lapsed because I couldn't afford to keep it up. But I got that membership. And, yes, the plan seemed to work, although... It's unusual for me to be that disciplined and to have a plan. Normally I just sort of, yeah, we'll go with that. But it worked.
I mean, something which I found really interesting was, so it was like early 2000s when you came back, and as your website says, like you spent that time specifically wanting to explore the kind of genre you're going into. Why was that important to you?
I think because when you write, you have... I have to have a certain interest and a certain fascination with what I'm writing. I know a lot of writers who consider it and can consider it to be a job. I'm lucky enough, I actually love the writing, so I'm earning a living doing something I love doing. But if I stopped loving it, I think I'd stop giving it my all and I'd stop doing something that I consider to be worthwhile. So I'm probably saying a lot of things which a lot of people who teach writing or any sort of creative writing would go against. But I don't tend to plot very heavily. I tend to write in quite an organic fashion. I like my characters to develop and to surprise me. And science fiction is what interested me. That's still the thing that I look at and think, you've got potential here. What if this happened? And I remember, even if you're a long, long time ago on the radio, where I was asked, you know, what is science fiction to you? And how come science fiction isn't predicting everything that goes on in the world? That's not science fiction's job. Science fiction is not the literary of prediction. It's the literary of potential. It's the literary subgenre or genre that says, what if? What if this were to happen? What would society look like as a result of this? And you explore it. And in that way, you A, let your imagination go wild, but also B, you can sometimes do something constructive to say, hey, do you realize if we carry on doing this, this could be the result. So I'm not saying that every science fiction story has a moral value or a moral tenet to it, but that is something that it can carry with it. And you can actually do at the same time as you're writing something and creating something just for pleasure and for entertainment. You can also put a deeper meaning in there as well. And I like that idea. I like the whole dichotomy of what you can do with words and what you can do with storytelling.
Yeah, and I think it also sort of that question puts the horse before the cart for me, because when there are things which come out of science fiction, it's usually because they've inspired someone. Like the mobile phone, that came out communicated because someone thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I had this thing which flipped open like a communicator? And worked in that fashion. And so it's not so much that science fiction writes the future as it inspires people who then create it.
I think that's very important. I think something that science fiction can do is it can help people to, as I said earlier, that it encouraged me to think outside the box. And I think if somebody has a technological bent and an inventive bent, it can perhaps encourage them to do things in a slightly different way and to be innovative in what they're doing and the fields they're working in. I mean, I've heard it said before that a lot of the top people behind the internet and all sorts of things in their youth, they read science fiction. And so I'm not saying that they copied what was in science fiction by any means, but I think it helped them look beyond the norm and look within the framework of standard teaching. This is science. This is how you do things. And look what could be done outside of that and beyond that. And I think science fiction encourages that. Whether my writing does is a different matter, but, you know, hey, we do our best.
So getting back to the sort of like arc of how it went for you, so you've got these short stories published, you were sort of like getting a decent hit rate with that. How do you then start spinning that into kind of making it more of a profession and more of a kind of ongoing thing?
That's a very good question. I mean, I went the very traditional route, and I know that it's something I've heard doesn't work anymore, which is I wanted to be the best writer I could be at that time when I came to write a novel. And to do that, I wanted to master the short story form because it requires a lot more economy of words, a lot more. You have to be far more succinct in a short story. You haven't got the space to indulge yourself and indulge different things. You have to, every word has to count in a short story. You have to make it serve a purpose in being in the story. And so it teaches you disciplines, which when you come to write a longer form, can be very useful disciplines to apply in a longer story arc. So I determined to try and master that first. I got, I suppose, about 24 sales under my belt. I got shortlisted for a BSFA award and, you know, a few other things that made me think maybe I'm doing something right here. And then I thought, okay, let's tackle the novel. So I started putting a novel together. By now, I was going to conventions, I was meeting editors, I was meeting agents. And so I was able to say to one of these, I'm writing a novel now. And a couple of them said, right, let's do some sample chapters. And that's really how it all started for me. I sent sample chapters and, you know, it went from there.
And at that time, what was the kind of like state of play at sci-fi conventions? Because I know the kind of arc of it went from comic books and authors and that sort of makeup to being more TV. And that kind of not took over, but kind of became the main kind of focus. And yeah, what was it like at that stage?
Well, no, I mean, I started going in 2004, and I was dragged there kicking and screaming by a friend of mine, Ian Watson, who is an author. You know, he worked with Kubrick. He wrote the very first Warhammer 40,000 novels. And Ian was guest of honour at a small convention in Birmingham, in Walsall, called NovaCon. He said, come to a convention. I said, no, it wouldn't be for me. No, that's not my sort of thing. But I went along and I ended up meeting lots of people there who I was very impressed with. It was about 250 like-minded people who like reading science fiction. But I met John Courtney Grimwood, I met Gwyneth Jones, I met Charlie Stross, I met Storm Constantine, I met a lot of people who would go on to be, you know, many of them very good friends. And I suddenly thought, you know, I had a good time. I had a fair bit to drink. I got involved in some ridiculous quiz programs. I met people. And so I then went to the Eastercon, the British National Science Fiction Convention, which has been going for, I don't know, 50, 60 years now. And so I was going very much to the literary conventions, which is still there. I would say are still going, but this year has slightly derailed that. But, yeah. You know. But, you know, they're still going. And so as a result of that, that's where I was meeting the editors, the agents and other authors. So it was very much the literary side. It was only later when I started going to the SF Weekenders and Nine Worlds, as was, and things that it began to. I've never really done the Comic-Con side of things. I know many authors have, and many authors have got involved in the comic writing, which I tend not to have done to date. But it's very much the literary things and then SF Weekender, et cetera, that I've been going to.
Yeah, and you actually met Ian through the Northampton Science Fiction Writers. Which, by the way, Northampton's my second favourite of all the Hamptons. In Southampton here myself. But I just wanted to kind of like just basically highlight that because I think it is amazing what these kind of groups, which may seem small to some people, but that's where kind of like so much talent is born and encouraged or nurtured, I think.
I think that's very true. I mean, I think they're also very undervalued these days in the days of self-publishing, especially. It used to be that you only got published via the big publishers, and if that didn't work, you were struggling. But what writers' groups did was put a group of people, be it four, five, six, a dozen or so people together with similar aims, writing similar sort of stuff. And it enabled you to critique what they were doing, them to critique your stuff. And it was amazing how often you get some feedback saying, oh, actually, I can see what you mean there. And I wouldn't have spotted that myself. So thank you. Or alternatively, you can be editing someone else's piece and thinking, that's a silly mistake to make. hang on, I do that too. And so you can see an error that you make in someone else's work. And so from that perspective, it was very useful. And having somebody of Ian Watson's caliber, you know, a scholarship from Oxford University in English, from Balliol College, highly respected author who knew how to use the language, to have somebody like that chairing the group was a huge advantage, and taught me an awful lot.
And you spoke about the editing side of it there, which you now do as a part of your kind of your umbrella of activities you do as a writer. Do you still find that? Do you still find you kind of like learn and grow as a writer yourself through doing that?
I think you're always learning. I mean, it's not in the same way it used to be, but you're always learning. The day you stop learning is the day when your own growth as a writer, as a professional, stops. Nowadays, it's a lot more intense. I mean, when I started NewCon, I really knew very little about editing, so it was learn as you go. Nowadays, I think I know quite a bit about editing. I think I know what I'm doing. I have certain, I won't say quirks as an editor, but certain things I look for in editing. There are certain word repetitions that people use unconsciously. All writers have certain tics that they might include in their stories, which they're not aware of. I mean, when I first started out, I overused the word just an awful lot and was pulled up on it and pointed out. And as soon as someone said that, I could look and think, yeah, you're right. I hadn't seen that. And it's not a necessary word most of the time. It can quite easily be expunged entirely or replaced with another alternative. And so this sort of thing is now something I'm fairly competent at. But you never stop learning. You always see stuff. I was actually editing a book this afternoon, which a delight to edit, fantastic book. And there's a word that I'd never come across before. And it's great. It's like, you know, when you first started reading and you sat the dictionary beside you. Now it's Google, but it used to be the dictionary. Oh, right, that's what that means. And it's always a delight. And your vocabulary, your understanding of the language progresses every time, all the time.
You just gave me such flashbacks to school with a little yes. story kind of going, yeah. coming through. I digress. But like, I think kind of editing is such a specific skill as well, because I you know, how do you go about finding like what is that writer's voice and finding what is kind of something which needs kind of like work on? You know, it seems like catching air.
You can never, from my perspective, I try to never interfere with the writer's voice. But there are certain things that are right and wrong, and there are certain things that a writer might do which comes across as a little bit clunky on the page, which might be a fairly natural way of speaking. But on the page, you just say, well, hang on a sec, you've done this four or five times now. Maybe we just slightly restructure the sentences here and there. And you're not trying to affect their voice, but what you are trying to do is stop a reader from getting annoyed by a sentence. And you don't want the reader to read and think, that's not how it should be said. That's not how it should be written. So you just try and smooth it out. Narrative flow is very important. You have to capture the reader. You have to get their attention. You have to get them involved in the story. And if you throw in little log jams, which make them bounce back, then you're in danger of losing them. So you've got to strike a balance between never affecting the voice if you can possibly help it, but also making the story the best it can possibly be and the most accessible to a reader that it can possibly be.
Yeah, I think when you do write and you get edited, you suddenly realize like how many of those things you also do in your speech. Yes. As well, like words you overuse, like for me, run-on sentences are the worst, which I know I completely do in conversation as well.
I don't know, as I say, that there were certain words such as just. When I first started at the Northampton SF group, Ian Watson had a bugbear about it, and I became very self-conscious of that. And I used to pull authors up because it's very easy to use the word it to stand in for any noun or anything. And you can end up seeing a sentence which has three its on it in it, and each instance of it refers to a completely different thing. And you're relying on the reader's intuition, if almost from context, to interpret what it means. Now, if you take one or two of those its and just put the noun in or an alternative, suddenly the narrative can flow so much more smoothly, almost at a subconscious level, because you're not which, oh, that's it. And so it's things like that that you're just trying to smooth over as an editor, just to make sure you want that story to be represented in the best way possible. You want it to be the best thing it could possibly be. And that's what I aim to do as an editor. And yes, there are sometimes authors who fight against that a little bit and say, well, no, I want this word. I've had a situation before where an author insisted on something being in there which was grammatically incorrect. And I had to explain that, no, that can't go in there. Even though you might say that, it's not right. I mean, I had one particular author who insisted on a French word being spelt wrong in their story because they'd taken the word from the menu of a French train, and it was clearly being spelt wrong on the menu. They said, I've got the menu here. That's how it's spelt. That's how it's going to be in my story. It's obviously correct. And it was wrong. But at the end of the day, this was fairly on in the days, I thought, okay, you're the author. You're a much bigger name than I am. We'll go with it. Nowadays, I would have to tactfully say, actually, look here, it's wrong. I think I've learned from that not to be intimidated so much by authors of a great deal more experience than I have. You have to have confidence in your own knowledge and ability.
I think the best kind of thing I ever heard about editing was when they, Blackadder, when they were talking about writing that, and it's, I'm trying to remember, so it's Ben Elton and I think it was John Lloyd, and they were saying about, like, they'd write an episode each and then they send it to the other one, and then the other one would completely rewrite it, and you had to be crying yourself to sleep before you said, like, no, I'm not happy with this change. And it kind of forced them to be more creative and just get better, you know, influenced by each other. And I think that's kind of what I've always held. When I write and I get edited, I just like, no, just take it. Unless you really think that that's changing your voice, you just have to, you have to listen, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very true. If only every writer thought like that. With my editor's hat on.
If you like Blackadder, just listen.
Yeah.
So it says on your website again, like that, which I can tell, by the way, that you wrote your own website. You can tell when an author, especially, I think, has written their own website, because it's very self-deprecating. Like, there's loads of things. Some idiot gave me an award, but like, they seem to be saying otherwise. But I digress. It says on there that if I buy you a pint, that you'll tell me about Newfound Press. So if you'll hold me a pint instead, then maybe you can tell me about it.
How we founded NewCon, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. It basically, again, through the Northampton SF Writers Group, we organised a convention, which turned out to be a very good little convention. None of us knew anything about organising conventions. We ended up with, I think, 30 people turned up. We had some fantastic guests, including Fangorn as our guest of honour, who would, he'd just worked on War of the Worlds with Spielberg and as a Hollywood conceptual artist. Again, he'd worked with Kubrick on AI, artificial intelligence, and, you know, so a big, big name. We had John Courtney Grimwood and Liz Williams, two fantastic authors, as guests. We had Gwyneth Jones turn off on the spur of the moment just to turn up. Ian Watson was chairing. So we had quite a range, and other authors and things turned up. And we ended up with about 30 people attending. So it lost money. Our fault entirely. We didn't market it. We didn't go to the right people. I looked and thought, I'm not covering any of this debt. It's lost. Some of my friends are. How do we get the debt back? I know I could write a book. That's what I can do. But nobody's heard of me. So I decided to do an anthology and got involved. Most of the authors who've been there submitted stories. We put it out to raise funds, and it basically covered the debt. I then sort of looked at the book when it came out, forgetting all the trials and tribulations that had gone on before it, you know, everything that from proofings that come out, proof copies differently, and all of it forgotten. Just thought, I did that. I could do it again. And that's how New Compress started, really.
That's lovely. And, like, I mean, what did you learn from that, though? Like, you know, what were the kind of early successes and what were the earlier challenges of forming a new press like that?
Well, it's changed all the time, because originally New Compress was just going to be a sideline to my writing, and I was just going to produce one or two titles a year as a hobby. It's grown beyond that, and continues to grow. In fact, I have to fight almost continually to stop it from getting even further out of control, because for some reason people seem to think that we're doing okay, and suddenly I've got some fairly exciting and major and authors who I like coming to me and saying, would you be interested in publishing my book? And I find it very difficult to say no, which is not a good thing. I'm having to learn to. But it's as I say, you learn all the time and the market changes. I mean, when I started out, there were no ebooks, and ebooks have changed the market. Audiobooks are coming on now, and it's a changing marketplace. The anthology market, when I started doing New Compressor, there wasn't one. All the big publishers stopped doing anthologies because they made no money. I looked and thought, where they can't make it, maybe I can. So I decided to bring out an anthology. Now all the small presses are doing anthologies. So, you know, the market changes and you have to react and you have to look at that and change accordingly.
It is amazing, really, how sometimes when the market moves on, and as you've kind of indicated there, it can be secular, but it's where the bigger industry, if you like, kind of moves in one direction, the smaller presses can take up that space. And I think that's kind of something lovely about that. So is that what you always try and do, find the things that they're not doing and then do it?
To an extent, yes. But I mean, I've always used one yardstick for when it comes to, God, look at the age of myself, yardstick. But once, you know, one gauge for when it comes to whether I accept a story or whether I don't. And that's, if I read this story in a book or if I bought this book, would I be pleased to invest my money in it? So New Compress really is a reflection of my taste. Goodness knows what that says about my taste, but it's the stuff I publish is stuff I'd be happy to publish. And it's a case of, I know that not everyone is going to have the same taste as me, but hopefully a lot of people do. And so far, touch wood, that seems to be working. But yes, at the same time, you're always looking to try and do something to fill a gap. I mean, as you say, the big publishers, they have a much larger budget. It's like a ship, a cruise liner. It takes longer to turn and a yacht can turn on a sixpence. So I can perhaps react to situations a little more swiftly than them, even though they might do, in the long run, a far more detailed and a far better funded job than I'm capable of doing. I can look at something and say, well, I think there's a niche here. I think at the moment this isn't being satisfied. And if you see that and you can see a way of fulfilling that need of producing a book of that type, you do it.
I mean, it's something which, like, I suppose when you get older, the more you look back to your parents and what they did. But, like, it just always makes me think of my dad had a chemist shop and he was, like, an independent chemist. And there was this kind of a couple of concoctions which he made up. And it wasn't big enough to be worth anyone else producing it en masse. So he'd make it up and, like, you know, you'd never see this in any chemist now. And he'd just make it up and he would supply it to local people. And he must have got lots of business of this. It never occurred to me at the time, but I think back to that of, like, how these kind of small businesses can react to those needs, which just aren't worth being satisfied, as it seems, by the bigger industry.
Oh, that's a brilliant story that reflects on, unfortunately, a far more, I won't say simpler, because that's always a very loaded phrase, but a far more naive times in many sense. And yes, it's lovely.
I mean, I think kind of like mass industry relies, you know, whether you take it that it's writing, movies, anything, on everyone being interested in the same thing and a big enough audience going to wherever you are. And I think it's just so fascinating how the world is moving back to small business more and more. And then the big business have to kind of try and create.
You're right. And that very much applies in the publishing side of things, because the large publishers, when they take on a title, they have to justify not only to the creative side, but now to the money men, why they think this book is going to make money. If it's a new author, they have to say, well, look, I think this or that or the other. And I know that it's not always easy for them. They don't always get through the titles they'd like to publish, because the people holding the purse strings look at it and think, no, I think that's too much of a gamble. I have benefited from that sometimes. I mean, one prime example was Nina Allen's book, The Race, which I know was turned down by some of the major publishing houses. And I spoke to one of the editors at one of them, and he said, I loved it, but I couldn't see how I could convince anyone it was going to make money. The Race came out through Newcon. It did really, really well and was subsequently picked up by Titan on the mass paperback front. But it may never have been published if it had just been down to the big boys. And that's the sort of way in which I think people like myself and like PS Publishing and many others out there can fulfil a role which perhaps otherwise would not get done. I like to think we're doing something useful anyway, so that's my excuse.
I mean, yeah, it seems like there is more and more outlets for anyone to be creative in any field, like podcasting. Anyone can have a laptop and they're a podcaster, you know, and yeah, they're in radio suddenly. People can even own their own stations. In the case of publishing, obviously, like yourselves, you kind of created your own publishing industry. And it's how much, like, do you think that's benefited the industry of writing? And what do you think the negative sides of everyone being a publisher are?
I don't know how much it's benefited. I mean, I think self-publishing is a double-edged sword. It gives people who might otherwise never have been published, who are very good authors, an opportunity to get their work out there. But it also means that you're losing, from a reader's perspective, the yardstick by which you can say, this is a good book or that isn't. Because all of a sudden now you've lost the filter, if you like, of going through an agent and a publisher. And now the poorest author in the world can self-publish their book. And how does the reader tell the wheat from the chaff? And that's the problem. I think perhaps where people like such as myself come in and the other small presses is that we've looked at something. I don't take on anything like all the stuff I get sent. I take on now between 15 and 20% of submissions I get, because I get so many, so I can pick and choose. Now, that doesn't mean that everything I publish is going to be to everybody's taste, but at least it means that I've liked it more than I've liked other things, and so that it's gone through a filtration process before it's been put out on the market. And I think that there are many, many readers who come to trust what Newcon are doing, what PS Publishing are doing, what Alchemy Press are doing, what these other publishers are doing, because they know the brand, they know the books they've published in the past, and it gives them a certain confidence that the book they're buying is one that they might be interested in. And so I think from that perspective, yes, we are fulfilling a purpose. Now, how important that is, and the other thing we're doing as well is there were a lot of authors going back 20, 30 years ago who might be on the mid list of the big publishers. They're not making a fortune, but they're ticking over and selling books. Well, now the big publishers don't publish them. So we're giving an avenue for very good authors who perhaps aren't justifying the market share that would see them getting a big contract. So there's different ways in which we can be useful. But to be honest, I've never looked at it any of those ways. I just look at it as I'm publishing stuff I want to read. I'm getting it out there, and I'm not yet out on the street from doing so. So I'm happy.
I mean, I just think it's kind of like, I think it's a wonderful thing we have less gatekeepers, because they could keep a lot of talent away from
yes.
kind of emerging. However, it's kind of when those gatekeepers go, and so does editing. Like, editing is really important, not only for like for what we receive as readers, but also how we grow as writers. I think we need that editing to improve to get to the standard.
I think you're very right. I think editing is an undervalued skill. And one thing I will say, as someone who writes as well, you can never effectively edit your own stuff. You just can't, because you have blind spots. You have things you read over 20 times. And there's actually a word missing, or a misplaced word in there, which you're reading over because you know what you're trying to say. You need a critical eye. You need an outside eye to look at it. So even somebody who myself, I edit for a living, I always, particularly with longer works, I always want someone else to read it and look at it and go through it and tell me where I've been a complete idiot, where actually that's not the word I meant to use at all, where that phrase simply is out of place, where I've misnamed a character, and all these things, which you become word blind to as the author.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing I want to talk about was, so we talked a bit about how the kind of industry has just naturally changed. Obviously, right now it's going to go through, and is going through, a huge change which was foisted upon us with COVID. What do you think that does to the kind of industry going forward, and what's it doing right now?
From my point of view, I don't know what it's doing to the industry as a whole, because I'm quite isolated. My interaction with the bigger publishers, the other publishers, was always at conventions, and they haven't happened. So whilst I do talk to people, it's nothing like the same extent. So I feel to a certain extent I'm outside, I'm out of the loop when it comes to what's going on in the industry as a whole. From my perspective, I went into lockdown very concerned because we'd lost a lot of money. We'd invested in various bits and pieces. We were going to debut at London Book Fair and had paid to be in catalogues and things and all sorts of stuff. And London Book Fair was cancelled with about 5 days' notice. So all the catalogues were printed. All the money spent couldn't be recouped because it had been spent. We'd spent a fortune, thousands and thousands of pounds, on having books printed for book launches that were suddenly all cancelled at conventions in London and all sorts of things. So I was quite concerned about how that left Newcon because we were quite exposed going into lockdown financially. But it's actually been a very good trading period. We've done various things. A lot of the authors who would have been at EasterCon and World HorrorCon and things like this very kindly recorded snippets of readings and things. We had a virtual book launch. We've done sales. We've done promotions. We've done all sorts of things. And sales have been pretty healthy, touch wood. So it's gone well, and it seems to be physical books in particular have done pretty well on the whole. But that isn't true of every title, and I can't promise that's going to be true in 2-3 months' time. It's been true to date, but it is really a case of taking it day by day, month by month, and just analysing what's going on and trying to respond accordingly. We're in unknown territory, and nobody knows whether COVID's going to come back and hit us further in the winter, whether by next year's conventions we'll be back or not. It's suck it and see, it really is.
And what do you think it does to the process? Because part of writing, obviously, is experiencing and getting inspired by events going around. There's a lot of people right now who don't really get to leave the house much. You know, there's more, obviously, there's more things which are kind of going on where, like, lockdown's easing, questionably whether that's a good idea, I won't get into. But do you think it kind of affects how kind of inspired people are, you know, and their experiences going into writing?
Again, I can talk very much from my own point of view on that, in that I found it quite demotivating from a writing point of view. I completed a short story last week, and that's the first creative piece of writing I've done since going into lockdown. Now, when we were going into lockdown, I was just about to launch the third volume of my space opera trilogy, The Dark Angels, and that came out in May. So I was still doing the sort of final touches on that. But that the writing of that had been done by then. It was there, it was done, it was just polishing, it was just getting it laid out, doing the cover and stuff. Jim Burns, bless him, fabulous cover artist as ever. But that wasn't creative writing, that was all the other things around it. And this is the first story I've written since going into lockdown. And I think that's because I did find it suppressed my desire to be creative for a while. And I also had so much work going on with Newcon, both trying to react to the situation and also with future titles being planned, that it was easy for me to shelve my writing and think, I can come back to that when I'm feeling I can cope with it. I've got enough to keep me going 12 hours a day for the next, I don't know how many months. And so I was able to concentrate on the Newcon stuff. But certainly, it didn't inspire me to write, but I've got a book coming out in December from Neil Asher called Lockdown Tales. And this is all stuff written that centres on his Polity universe and what happens beyond Polity. But these are all stories he wrote during lockdown. So with Neil, it was a case of he found the isolation very, very inspiring from the point of view of getting down and getting to work. And he wrote, you know, it's 150 odd thousand words. And I know that's, he's got other things he wrote during that period as well. So I think it's affected different people in different ways. Some people just got down to it and went. With me, I found it fairly demotivating, but I had a lot of other things to keep me occupied, so it wasn't something I got overly concerned about.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it seems to be where you have so many strings to your bow. I would imagine that when there's maybe less inspiration for writing, it means you can immerse yourself in editing and doing these other roles which you've
prefer. Precisely. And that's what I've been doing. I'm now coming out of that, and I'm now planning my next novel, he said, hopefully, but that's still very early stages. I've got other things. But I don't know what's going to happen next month. I don't know what's going to happen come Christmas or next year. So I'm very much playing it by ear. What I'm not doing is making big plans for what I'm going to be doing next year, because I still think we've got a lot of surprises. I think there's a lot of fluidity in the world situation and within Britain's situation within that world, which will affect all of us health-wise, economically. So I think that's got to be looked at, and that will doubtless be reflected in how we go forward.
Yeah, definitely.
God, we're getting very deep and meaningful here, aren't we?
I call it content myself. you mentioned there your current book. Firstly, tell us a bit about it. So it's the third in the trilogy.
Oh, yeah. I started this trilogy back in 2015. A book called Pelquin's Comet came out, and it did quite well. It got number one sales in Amazon and stuff, and which was great, lovely. It's essentially taken... I mean, that book was compared to Firefly a lot because it had a small crew on board a ship. They had an outsider imposed upon them who was actually a representative of the bank who was funding an expedition they were going on, and the bank insisted he was there to look after the bank's interests. So it was the dynamics of a stranger introduced into a tight-knit group, and there were a lot of politics and things going on with aliens. And I wanted to take a trope, which was the idea of humanity reaching the stars as a result of or being bootstrapped that by discovery of alien technology and caches and things which were highly valued, and hence the treasure hunt and the ship going off. And I wanted to take that and turn it on its head, which I hope I do through the course of the trilogy. In the first trilogy, it becomes clear that the banking agent has a past which others aren't aware of, but it catches up with him slowly during the first book. That becomes the theme of the second book, in that he used to front a renegade band known as the Dark Angels, who were outlaws but had a reputation for doing good, although the good they did was almost always accidental rather than intentional. But they were... In effect, I don't know what to say to it, by the third book, it's basically the old gang getting back together because they have to, because they're being hunted down. They have to save the universe. And oh, by the way, because they've invested heavily in this alien technology and discovered a very big cache many years ago, they're virtually all superheroes. So it's in effect superheroes in space with aliens. And so it goes from being one thing into something that's quite, it's a bit of a romp and a fun, but I'm able to mess around with some serious themes under the guise of having great fun. And the books did what I wanted them to. I was really pleased to get them finished. I was sorry to say goodbye to some of those characters, because I don't have any immediate intentions of revisiting that universe or those characters. I say this so vaguely because in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, I might be sitting there thinking, well, I could always do this and do that. But for the moment, that story is told from my perspective. But who knows? Life's a strange thing.
And that came out in June, am I correct?
Yeah, that came out in May. And the weird thing was, it got a couple of very good reviews. And Pelquin's Comet, the first book, which came out in 2015, suddenly went to the top of the Amazon sales charts again, which was totally unexpected byproduct. I was in a great situation where at one point I was sitting there and I had the three books all in the top 50 of Amazon Space Opera, which is something I just sat there and thought, really? You know, amazing, absolutely fantastic experience. I'll probably never be there again, but I enjoyed it while it lasted.
So, like, and that at that time was just when we're going into lockdown, if I'm remembering my plague correctly. And how does that go, like launching a book just when we're entering into this pandemic? I mean, still now, obviously, it's a mess, but at least it's an organized chaos now.
It was very tough, and I felt sorry not only for myself, but I had a couple of excellent books coming out at the same time, which were due to be launched at EasterCon in Birmingham. And it didn't help because Amazon suddenly stopped stocking books to the extent they did. So I was bringing out, there's a fantastic book by an Irish author called Rachel Kelly, R.B. Kelly, which is a wonderful book. And actually it has certain implications for what we're going through, in that it does involve a plague going through a city, which was obviously not foreseen when she wrote it. But it's a fantastic book. But Amazon suddenly weren't stocking it. So whereas normally all my title shows in stock in Amazon and they sell and I get copies sold every month and everything through the different Amazon stores, because they said Amazon claimed that their warehouse space was being prioritized for things that people considered essential, and therefore the space previously being allocated to books was no longer being allocated. So titles like this and a fabulous book by Nick Wood, which was Water Must Fall, which was looking at Africa and also areas of America, but particularly focusing on Africa and the situation of going forward when water is becoming scarce and becoming the most valuable commodity, and big business takes a criminal interest and control and monopoly of water. These books suddenly you couldn't buy through Amazon. And that was heartbreaking for myself and from me trying to represent the authors and sell these books to try and find ways around that and badger Amazon and stuff. And it's, it hasn't been easy. But, yes, you cope the best you can. I can't affect the situations around here. I can't make Amazon do something. I can't make COVID go away. I just have to accept that this is the new reality and respond to it as best we can by doing virtual book launches and things like this, which we did. So we do our best.
Yeah, certainly. Something else I want to get onto before we finish our chat is the R.C. Clarke Awards. I mean, just you're a judge on that panel?
I was. I'm not anymore. When you're a judge for the Clarke, I understand this isn't a constitutional thing, but it's always been the tradition that you judge for 2 years. I found it an incredibly intense experience, fantastic. But I was, at the time I judged my first year, it was the highest intake of books they'd ever had. I think it was 113 submissions. And for various reasons, we were somewhat concertinaed in the time we had to read and consider these books. So it was an incredibly intense experience. I knew the book I wanted to win. And of course, it's not just me, there's four other judges. And we ended up sort of daggers drawn in a darkened room. No, it wasn't quite like that, but it was not far off it. The first year I was there, Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice one, which was the book that I loved. I thought it just put a whole new spin on space opera, and I loved that. I then took a year out, and I was persuaded to come back earlier than I'd intended by Tom Hunter, the awards administrator, and the Mr. Arthur C. Clarke. And that year, Adrian Tchaikovsky won with his Children of Time, which I thought was a phenomenal book again. So very proud of that, very grateful. But after 1 year of doing that, I then basically stopped reading science fiction for pleasure for a year because I'd read so much. So I started reading old Penguin classics and picking up on authors I should have read in my teens or my 20s, who I'd never read. And I took a whole break from genre fiction because I was just science fictioned out. You know, I really was.
I actually want to give a shout out to Adrian. Now, I met him and had the pleasure of interviewing him as well as yourself at Sci-Fi Weekender. And man, if there's ever a writer who is just as quirky as you want a writer to be, it's him. He's wonderful.
Oh, Adrian's great. I mean, I had the pleasure of losing to him at an award at the last SF Weekender in Yarmouth and of collecting the award on his behalf. And, it would have been great if I'd won it, but the next best thing was picking it up for Adrian. He's a great writer, a good friend, and, a worthy winner of that.
And the other one, which I just wanted to touch upon as well, is that I don't know if we're or are the director of the British Science Fiction Association.
Yes, I chaired it for about 4 or 5 years, the organisation, through a fairly tricky time, but we came out of it better than we went into it. I then handed the reins over to Donna and ran away and let her handle all the madness involved. And Donna's now handed it on to Alan Stroud. Yes, I remain a director, and I keep an eye on things from a distance. And it's an organisation that's quite dear to my heart. And yeah, it's been going now for, I think, over 60 years, just over 60 years. It's been around for a fair old time. It's an organisation that some people think is no longer relevant. I personally think it is. It's a visible heart of British fandom. And it's good to have something like that that actually has a focus, provides a focus for fans, not all of whom could get to conventions, not all of whom can do things. Podcasts such as this do a fantastic job of linking people and bringing people together. But it doesn't hurt to have an official body there to do to be a focal point. And I think the BSFA does that. So I'm very pleased to be involved with it. I'll always have time for the organisation.
And between that and the Clark Awards, I mean, just it must be just a wonderful moment to, like, these are things which I get that you followed previously and you're a fan of. And
oh, yeah.
To the heights with it must be just a tremendous feeling.
Before I got involved in the community, in the industry as such, I remember getting a list of all the winners of the Arthur C. Clarke Award and determining I was going to read them all, because I knew that the books were considered sometimes a bit quirky and a bit out there, but generally of very high quality. I still haven't read them all, but I've read the vast majority of them. And so to suddenly go from that to being a judge for the award is surreal, to be honest. It's a, you know, a pinch me moment. And a year or two after I last was on the award panel, I had the honour of presenting Anne Charnock with her award when she won the award as well. And that was great, because Anne's a friend, someone I've published as well. And it's stuff like that that makes it. We've got a very special community. I value it enormously. I value the people involved, and I feel privileged to be a part of it and to have played some small part here and there in helping to promote and helping to continue that community. It's a very special place.
Yeah, and I like to wrap up these things by asking for a little bit of advice from my guests, because clearly, as a man in his 40s who's still going around calling himself the squeeze, I need all the help I can get. So I want to ask you, like, what is your advice for writers who may be struggling during this time of such uncertainty?
I would honestly say, and this is something I generally say to anyone who is looking to establish themselves as a writer, find like-minded people who you can discuss writing with, who you can discuss stories with, who you can critique. In effect, a writer's group, they used to call them, physically, if possible. In this day and age, you can't necessarily meet physically, but we have this wonderful thing in front of us, the computer, the internet, the phone. It's perfectly possible. The BSFA run writer's groups online where, you know, you critique stories every 2 weeks. You get to know the people, you get to know each other. And it's not just a case of you have an impersonal connection with other people who are writing. You get to know them as individuals. And that connection is very helpful, as well as the professional side of, well, this guy, he says this, he says that. I've got six people telling me that aspect of my story is wrong. Maybe I ought to have a look at that again. It's encouragement, it's support. And particularly in the current circumstances, I think that sort of support from your contemporaries, from people who are possibly going through similar things to you, have similar ambitions to you, I think that could be invaluable. So I'd say link up with something online. And if you are struggling to find somewhere to link online, contact the BSFA. They can put you in touch with people. They can put you in touch with people in your area or online, or put you in touch with the writers groups, anything. To help you connect with others who have similar interests and are maybe in the same boat as you are.
And just to add a little bit to that, like one thing which I find is a beautiful breeding ground for writers in better times than these, certainly, is science fiction conventions. Like they may get derided, and
yes.
Yeah, you know, that's all good fun. But that's where kind of like I was very privileged to meet yourself and many other writers who've inspired me greatly. Like the talks that you give at these conventions are wonderful and a great source of inspiration. I'm so lucky to be able to have these one-to-one conversations both here and at the conventions. And I think that's how it inspires the next generation of writers.
As a caveat to that as well, just to say that conventions, for me, they're A, great fun, B, from the Newcompest point of view, they're a great business opportunity, but C, they're fantastic for networking on a professional level. I'm just putting out an anthology in, I think it's come out end of October, called London Centric, which is stories based around London. And most of the authors in there are people I first encountered at conventions, people like Mike Carey, you know, who wrote The Girl with All the Gifts and created the Lucifer comics for DC that are now televised with Tom Ellis. He's got a story. I met Mike at a convention initially. There's a fairly new writer, Joseph Elliot Campbell, rather, who I met. Paul Cornell introduced me to him at the last EasterCon. There's Jeff Ryman, I met at my first ever EasterCon. And all these people I met through going to conventions, having a drink at the bar, and they become friends and they become people you can work with. Conventions are great. Yep, I'll endorse that. Go to conventions.
And just quickly, obviously there is ianwaites.co.uk, you know, where they can check out all your work. Is there anywhere else that you can send people?
Newcom Press. To be honest, the Ian Waites site, it tends to be the one, being, as you say, a self-deprecating individual. Newcon's where I go far more often. The Ian Waites site, I really must update. You've reminded me. You've made me feel guilty. Newcompress.co.uk is the other one.
Okay. Well, I should have had a banner ready for that, but I don't, of course. Ian Waites, thank you so much. I can't wait until we can meet up again in the real world and I can...
Likewise. And Ian, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure. The time's flown by. I hope we haven't put too many people to sleep. And yeah, see you again at the convention soon.
Well, as long as we put them to sleep after they start watching, I'm good with that. That's fine.
Okay. All right.
Okay. No, thank you very much, Ian. It's been a pleasure. I've been Dr. Squee. That was Ian Waites. And that was Ian Waites. It flips my camera. Anyway. And that was the Dr. Squee Show.